Call the tax committee to order. Senator Youngbauer, Senate File 1740.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First of the chair, I'd like to say thank you for a great Ranger experience last night. And
was there anything in the newspaper? Anybody get in trouble? I didn't hear anything.
I don't know. Those of us who had to be here early, I don't think we had a chance to read the newspaper. We're trying to get up to speed for our committees. Mr. Chair and members, I have Senate File 1740. Is for the City of Anoka. It involves tax increment financing on our rail stop for the North Star Corridor. And I have with me Bob Kirshner from the City of Anoka, and he will give you the highlights of the project.
Thank you, Senator Youngbauer, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Tax Committee. For your record, my name is Robert Kirshner, and I am the Community Development Director at the City of Anoka. With me to address any questions if needed are the City Manager, Tim Cruikshank, the Finance Director, Lori Yeager, and the Planning Director, Carolyn Braun. Also contributing to our process has been Ellers & Associates, specifically Shelley Eldridge and Mark Ruff, and Attorney Bob Dyke, who drafted our legislation. And we also worked with LHB Architects to do an initial survey of our area for tax increment eligibility. And we'll speak to that a moment later. As general background, we're talking about the Anoka stop on the North Star Corridor system. And it's an old industrial neighborhood that dates back to the 1850s. So we've had 150 years of activity in that area, many different types of industrial uses. That's clearly in a stage of transition today. It's gone through several before, but now I think it's probably going to shift away from its historic use as industrial type uses to more residential and commercial. In fact, we've done a number of land use plans and other studies that have guided this thinking. A series of land use plans, community-based, with consultant, but with a lot of public input. And the vision has been that this should be an urban kind of environment, high-density buildings, four-story buildings perhaps in parts of this area. And that was based on a lot of public input, which actually surprised some of us that people saw that type of urban vision for the station. We also did a market study that confirmed that this really is a residential, perhaps with some commercial type use, although we're kind of open the option of job-based clean room, high-density job-based manufacturing as a possibility. The residential is kind of the focus. So with that in mind, we started looking at how can we assist where needed to convert this area from its historic use as industrial to more of a residential neighborhood. And we identified a number of significant challenges. This aerial map I can get into later if you like, but essentially we have major industrial uses. We have bulk plants, operating bulk plants. We have sites that were operating bulk plants, lumber yards, a whole range of industrial type uses. Also a double turn rail spur. So this historically was everything that came into Anoka came through this area and was offloaded. So we likely will find many environmental surprises as we get into it. We know something about that already. We know there's at least seven identified tanks, some of which had leaked, one of which is currently active case. And so the environmental question is a significant one for us, as well as just making that transition from existing industrial use toward residential where it's feasible to do. With that introduction, I think I'll refer to your handout and just kind of highlight these pages for you since you have that in front of you, I believe, beginning with the map showing the two bullet target areas. The crosshatch area is the actual station area itself, where today we have a parking lot on each side of the track, very close to being ready for the train to be operating in November. That first ring is a one-quarter mile radius. And studies show that a quarter mile or up to a half mile are the impact areas, or hopefully the positive economic impact areas for these train stations. And that smaller circle is really the focus of our interest here in terms of facilitating redevelopment. The larger circle is the half mile radius, which does bring in a large portion of our community. Turning the page to the next one, which focuses on the quarter mile, and overlaid with that, you see a heavy line in essentially a box or square. That is the boundary that we're proposing here to be authorized to work within under a redevelopment district standard, and having flexibility to operate in that area. and over a period of time. That has some natural boundaries. The north side is Garfield Street and actually bumps up against the state and county facilities, social service facilities. 7th Avenue on to the right or the east is a county road. Ferry Street over on the left or west is the State Highway 169. And on the south side is U.S. Highway 10. So we kind of have a physical limitation to the area that we're talking about, which approximates the quarter-mile radius. Going to the next page, you see that in a broader context within the entire city. City of Anoka, 7 square miles, largely developed. We're in a redevelopment mode now. And we see the train station as our next great frontier. We've done our industrial park. We're still doing rehabilitation throughout the community and the core city historic commercial area. The train station is our future. It's a repeat of the 1860s when we got our first train station, and we had a community up there. It was actually a second downtown, you might say. And this is really history repeating itself, but probably more of a residential character. So that's the context. The next page is our vision for the potential sources and uses in that area. The extent of the city's involvement is certainly open to market conditions. We really would like to see this area driven as much as possible by the private market as far as redevelopment is concerned. But given the fact we have in place significant potential obstacles environmentally and changing land use, as well as the need for infrastructure improvements, transportation-related improvements of a more global nature in the neighborhood, we expect the city will be playing a role in this redevelopment area. I won't go through the details, but you can see the magnitude of what we could be talking about here in terms of costs. One major one would be structured parking. Although we have surface parking there planned and will be operating, at some point in time we anticipate perhaps the need for structured parking to contain the scale. We talk about contain and retain in Anoka. We like to keep things, but we don't like some things to get too big. And this is one of those cases we like to concentrate parking at some future date. We also anticipate some significant improvements to roads entering into that area, as well as replacing much of the infrastructure to accommodate this higher density urban environment. Then moving to the narrative, and I won't go through the details of it. I'll just highlight a few things. On the second page of the narrative, we do talk about why we don't think a tax increment district will work in one point in time. I can tell you, and I can show you if you wish, we've done the analysis that shows that we could create one very massive tax increment district of a redevelopment type in that area. We've surveyed 27 buildings. Many of those are structurally substandard. The ratio between the improved area and the vacant area can be met. So we could establish this massive district. It would be about 100 acres or more, could be more than 100 parcels. We don't think strategically that's a wise move on our part. We don't need to do that at one time, but we'd hate to have one project trigger that entire thing. The problem with that approach is that it captures too many parcels, many of which aren't going to be in play for years. And we think it would be more strategic to take selected parcels within that authorized area as the market drives it. And also, as we deal with property owners, there's a financial aspect to this that makes it more efficient to not have all these parcels being carried in a district unnecessarily. There's an advantage, as noted in here, that if we can phase in parcels over up to a 10-year period, we probably could realize a greater revenue off the district, because we'll be targeting the time frame within which those particular developments would occur. But there's another aspect to this, and my experience tells me that sometimes it's more significant than numbers, and that's dealing with the property owners and working with them on a basis that permits them to make a free market decision when it's right for them to make that decision. And I can tell you, in talking with owners out there and getting access to buildings, they anticipate this project coming, but they aren't necessarily ready to make their decision today or tomorrow or maybe 5 years from now. But they do see themselves in a position to make a change in what they're doing in about 10 years, in some cases longer. That actually, I think, triggered our thinking about how can we work with them to be more surgical, more strategic, allow for those activities to go on during this phase-in period, 10 years. And then when the market is right and have a willing buyer, willing seller situation, development can occur.
Yeah.
And I think the idea behind that, excuse me, is to minimize the role of the city and to try to maximize the private sector's involvement in this project.
That's very broad.
So yeah. That's kind of the philosophy behind what we're asking for. I think this gives us an opportunity to bring that kind of flexibility to the project and to allow for property owners to work with their own time frames. I'll just sum up with some of the key points on the last page. This really is a locally initiated kind of concept that we think applies to our particular situation. It's designed to be responsive to market conditions. When the market is ready, we can react rather than maybe reacting prematurely with a district anticipating. Maybe we'd rather react to what market is coming to us.
But I think
number three, and I think it's an important one, we're sensitive to the existing property owners' time frames. And in today's world, we're not going to go out there and condemn property for public purpose, or for other than public purpose. We're not going to do that for redevelopment purpose. And we have a history in Anoka of not condemning property even for a redevelopment purpose. I've not been involved in one of those in 30 years. We had very few eminent domain cases, and they've all been surrounding value. So that's been a philosophy we followed to work with property owners. It allows for that additional time that will be necessary because eminent domain is not going to be applied to the redevelopment scenarios other than where public purpose might be involved, and I don't really even see that being involved in this case, because there is some significant public land that we can work with. It allows for some extended time to assemble property. We have bulk plants, some industrial warehouses, city public works, electric utility facility that we have probably a 10-year time frame for looking at relocating. That allows us to stage those parts of the development. And we are working within what would be a typical one-quarter mile radius impact area for a transit-oriented development. That's right. Maybe typically a larger area than you'd get into with tax increment anyway in terms of a single project. So staging it makes sense in that respect. And lastly, I'd suggest that Anoka area is a little bit different than some of the other stations along the line where we do have an old industrial area that is really looking to be changed and transfer to new uses. So we need that flexibility in order to work with those unique circumstances. I think I'll stop there. We can address questions. I can supply more information about our analysis that we did that demonstrates we can do this big district, but we really prefer not to. And other people on our team could perhaps address other questions you might have. And thank you again for this time to appear before you.
Mr. Kirchick, the expiration. So once this is authorized, you'd have 10 years to set up little sub-TIF projects within the boundary?
That's correct.
And then no limitation on waive the 5-year rule beyond. Right? Is that right?
The 5-year, the knockdown rule, or essentially the districts would be phased in, and each individual district would meet the typical TIF requirements. There would be the ability to pool within that area, but any, call it sub-TIF district, would have a 25-year limit.
Exempted from the 5-year.
Well, I think that's a fair question, and I think the phasing in between the two items, the phasing in is more important to us than the 5-year rule, because it.
Unless you wish to answer that, you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I think the key concept for us is the ability to phase in each individual parcel or collection of parcels over a 10-year period. The 5-year rule is not as significant to us as that phase in.
I would think in that 10-year period when you set those districts up, you'd have some idea what that development's going to look like.
you wouldn't have created.
Yeah, I think your analysis is accurate based on our main objective.
So, Mr. Chair, is that
how many districts do you anticipate inside that boundary?
There could be, from two or three to maybe six or seven, depending upon how the parcels are aggregated. When I looked at the overall district area, and one of the reasons for having different districts is there's sort of areas or pods within the larger area that to tie together but aren't necessarily connected to each other. So it's possible there could be, depending on the size of the project, there could be maybe four or five smaller districts that could come together on an individual basis. If it's a single building, there might end up being more districts, but if it's a larger development that comes together, it could be fewer.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following along on the 10-year phase-in, so you'd have the 10-year phase-in, and then the term of each district is another 25 years after the first receipt of any TIF money?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoke, that's correct. Each district would stand on its own as a 25-year district, the first increment starting that 25-year period.
So, Mr. Chair, some of these could be 35 years.
Each district would have a 25-year limit. Within the larger area, you might have overlapping 35-year period, but any one district would be limited to 25 years.
Thank you.
Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, could council perhaps, I may be the only one at the table that's not understanding this five-year issue, but could council explain that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sundrum, the five-year rule is actually a part of the prohibition on pooling of increments from within the tax increment district to for expenditures outside of the district. The five-year rule essentially says that a district, the activities that are intended to be conducted within the district have to be set in motion within the first 5 years after it's certified. And the district will remain in effect for the up to the duration limit of the particular district, but that essentially, it was intended to have a plan in place for the district at the time it was created and then have that begin to be executed within that five-year period and not just keep adding, additional activities.
Okay.
So, Senator Sundrum, projects that happen in years six, seven, eight, you can't capture the increment.
Okay. I suppose to anyone, this is an exception for most TIFs that we do. Is that right? Seems like it. Or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sundrum, we've heard, the committee's heard, I would think, six or seven proposals already this year, and there are two more on the schedule for today. Through 2008, there had been 24 districts that had gotten either variations on the duration of the five-year rule or exceptions, 24 districts in 15 different cities.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Senator Jungbauer, or to your witness, I'm looking at, talks about the limitations on spending, but it kind of describes what some of the spending is going to be for. So I'm looking at line 2.11 and 2.12. The terms vehicular transit improvements and public improvements that are related to a proposed rail transit station. What are those? What is that?
Roads and the parking ramp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that includes roads that would be upgraded within that area of the TIP district. And any other improvements for the rail station itself. And actually, in that area, there's been some road improvements to gain better access as the rail station goes up already. So there's a lot of the groundwork that's been done for this that brings the TIF district here. City of Anoka has talked about it in the past towards that rail station for North Star. And this year, everything is falling in place. But part of the reason on the time frames is, as we all know, the market isn't something that we can predict today. Although we're seeing a lot of good things happen in terms of transit-oriented development and in terms of what goes on around the rail station. So it takes a degree of long-term planning, and you just kind of want to make sure you're covered and don't come back here to redo something. We're thinking in terms of another area not too far away from this specific rail station, our area that we have, Riverdale, in the Coon Rapids area, was a TIF district that had to be changed and extended a number of times until the development actually was driven through that area.
Senator Dibble.
So when you say the rail station itself, what does that mean?
I'll address that, Senator Dibble. The station site consists of the parking lots, the platform, the wind shelter protection, and the immediate access surrounding it. And that's identified here in red. And does exist largely. It needs to be finished out here with the last layer of blacktop and some landscaping and signage and things of that nature. But the station area is this area right here. And part of our strategy is to be able in the future to come in on a public-private ventured basis and bring in structured parking and possibly other taxable development. Hmm. So that's becomes kind of the focal point for the entire neighborhood strategy.
So, Senator Dole.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, so you don't anticipate that these increment proceeds would go to pay for aspects of the project that should be covered by the project itself? You know, the basic station, you know, and the amenities that are attached to the commuter rail project itself. You're not picking up those on a local basis.
Yeah, Senator Dibble, that's correct. The corridor has constructed the existing station to function. Our interest is long-term in the future growth of that station area and the need for structured parking, and also to see if we can attract some private development immediately adjacent or perhaps on top of the parking ramp, things of that nature. So it would be an add-on to what the system has created, and hopefully to create a real efficient station in the context of our neighborhood. We do anticipate perhaps 500 to 700 dwelling units being constructed around the station besides the existing residential that surrounds it. So it really will be a people-intensive neighborhood with a lot of walkers, and so we need to create an urban environment with that station in the future.
And Mr. Chair, members, also part of that was in our final sheet here where some of these costs redeveloping, that's why we ended up talking about percentages and developer paid and park dedication fees, and that kind of highlights what parts would be paid by the outside development as opposed to the district.
Senator Fogelmiller.
Mr. Cruikshank, just real quick, is there any, I don't mean important structures. I mean, are there any major structures within the redevelopment area?
Yes, Senator.
Significant businesses.
Senator Fogelmiller, yes, there are. There's one major industrial user right here. This white and dark area is a 200,000 square foot manufacturing plant. That's a very significant employer in our community. And we see that as a long-term tenant in that park area. Subject to market conditions, perhaps it would change, but we anticipate working with that development remaining. So that's probably the single most important use.
And is everything else there light industrial, or is everything else in the district kind of present homes in there?
All of this area right in here is older industrial. There's two bulk plants. There's a warehouse with trucking. There's a vacant studio from a theater, a home builder, and a machine shop. And down in here we have similar things. This is the public works garage here. We do have residential, which are non-conforming residential uses since the 1960s. along Highway 10. This area here is likely to take longer to change out, whereas this area here is the current focus of assembly where we expect there will be some obstacles for private development.
What's everything on the far right?
This over here, this is residential, primarily single, but some mixed apartments. There is additional bulk plant, former bulk plants here, some vacant land near an intersection. There's a couple large apartments. So this is mixed residential density, some 1870s homes, some 1960s homes, some 1960s and 70s, sixplexes and 24-plexes.
So it sounds
plexes.
Like kind of a lot of area ripe for development.
Talk about the river and stuff there.
Yes, you're correct. And I think another element here that's important is the environmental aspects of this neighborhood. I told you about the bad news, but the good news was we have a river here. And the Rum River, I think, is one of the defining elements that drives this toward a residential change. And like many communities that are shifting from industrial uses on the river, we're trying to shift away as well.
Mr. Chairman, just could ask, do you have a family member? I think it's Julie Cruikshank. Is she a family member?
This is the city manager's Cruikshank.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're Mr. Cruikshank.
Yeah.
You have is there a Julie in your family? She used to work for Sarah Cohen. Do you remember that? Julie Cruikshank.
I'll talk to you about that.
So
later.
He's not.
Whoa.
Former family member, apparently.
Former family member.
Okay. Are you the ex? Oh, okay. Sorry.
Mr. Kirshner, what's the purpose of the parking ramp, 450 stalls, and why should that, tell me why that should be included?
We anticipate this station outgrowing its existing allotted parking, and the long-range studies indicate that is probably going to happen. We're concerned about obviously retaining the station, but not having it spread into the neighborhood and being a lot of surface parking. So this contingency plan would make it possible to contain that station in a defined area, still allow for the needed parking, and make better use of the neighboring properties for private development. So it's the retain and contain strategy. We don't know that that's going to happen in the next year or two. I think it's going to be driven in part by the actual use that we see happening there next year. That'll be the first indicator. But that's not a project that we have committed to yet, but it's a contingency we are trying to plan for.
Something you need?
Today we don't need it, but 5 years from now we might need it.
And Mr. Kirshner, who will own it?
The city is owner of the properties and, in this case, would own the parking ramp.
Any other questions, members? I'm not sure about the parking ramp. Maybe we need to visit more about that.
Mr. Chair, members, we're always open to suggestions, and I noticed you talked about the 5 year, if whether we needed that or not. You think that you can help us make this work out so that we can move this sort of project ahead? We know that you guys get to listen to enough of these that, especially Senate Council, to understand. We don't want to create something that opens the floodgates either. We want something that makes sense and utilizes our tools available within a city, especially like it's redeveloping.
We did something fairly similar for Fridley around their transit station. But
right.
This is a little bit broader than what they proposed, and it took us a couple years to get Fridley's done. There was a lot of pushback from the other side of the table in the conference committee in here, if I remember right. So some narrowing of it might be easier to make you potentially be successful.
Mr. Kirshner?
Mr. Chair, maybe I can address that and offer some thoughts. The boundary we've established is somewhat arbitrary. it's easy to describe by the way as those streets, but that boundary could be looked at. There are areas that could potentially be pared out of that that may not be as material to our needs as that boundary currently indicates. This older residential neighborhood, for example, I think that's probably an optional in terms of change up there. That's going to remain. It may need some infrastructure help. It may need some rehab help, but it's not directly essential to the redevelopment part of the area. So, you know, if looking at the adjusting the boundary to a smaller scope is something the committee's interested, that's something we could address.
I think we'd probably be a little bit more interested in kind of restricting the area more to development around the rail station and not getting quite as far away. If you could just think about that.
Yes.
Senator Squid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just because I'm curious, when I look at your map and I see that land that looks relatively undeveloped along the river, is that land that would be suitable for housing? And it seems to me that would be perfect. Somebody could have, you know, nice housing buildings along there. They could walk to the rail station and go downtown. What is your thoughts for that area?
Yes, Senator Scola, you make a good point, and that is a strategy. There are some limitations on how much we can do there, but this area is an existing apartment complex, and that's not going to change. This area right here is actually now the storm drainage area for the whole neighborhood, triggered by the station, so that's off limits. There's probably area in here between 4th Avenue and the river that could be a choice residential site, although most of this area in here, more than half of this dimension here, is all wetland, so that will all be preservation. So in terms of immediate access to the river, in terms of a site, there may only be one here. The rest would be across the street, but in a close walk of the river.
And, Mr. Kirchner, why would that need TIF to be developed?
That might not need TIF to be developed. That's a good question, a good point. And our basic approach here is to try to focus revenues on tasks that are really needed. Right now, we're not sure how many of these things we're listing in our pro forma are actually going to be necessary. We do have properties here. We expect the development will occur on essentially without any tax increment assistance. However, in order to accommodate that development, we're going to have to do some other things in the area, and that has to do with redeveloping the industrial uses. So that's where we're likely going to have to use some tax increment. Our philosophy has been is that we don't subsidize developers. We assemble property when they won't. We clear up property from environmental contamination when they won't, and we get it ready for them. But at that point, we believe development should occur on a market basis. So that's our approach, and that's how we'd like to minimize what might be viewed as assistance to developers. And we believe we have property here that will develop without assistance, but we may need the revenue from that area to remove these other uses that are incompatible next door to them.
Well, Mr. Kirchner, developers are pretty good negotiators. They're going to know what you have in law, what's within your authority. And if you have a little more than you need, probably makes your negotiations a little more difficult with them, I would guess. Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Jungbauer, it seems to me that your project is reaching for the moon when really what you need is a bright, shining star. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with the chair in terms of limiting the ask here.
Senator Limmer?
Yeah. I yield to my
Senator Dibble.
Making me ask the question. is Anoka, Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, is Anoka in the transit taxing district?
Yes.
Could the parking ramp be construed as a park and ride lot? Then the region can help pay for it with a transit bond, their property tax.
I'm told we'd have to work with Met Council, but we're interested in accommodating a regional need, but containing it in a neighborhood environment. It's somewhat of a challenge, and that's why structuring the parking is a strategy we think ultimately we're going to have to address. Now, maybe it's 10 years from now, but to contain the potential growth of that, we think we need to be involved in that way.
Well, Mr. Chair, the
Senator Dibble.
Met Council, I mean, if you know, if part of the parking is going to be used for transit ridership, you know, maybe the cost could be shared with regional bonds.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we have a parking ramp in the city of Ramsey that was paid for partway under that, and that certainly, I think, would be an option for the city of Anoka as well to look at. So I'm, Mr. Chair, taking notes rapidly as to how we can pare this down and figure out the components we actually need.
Senator Youngbar, I appreciate that, and if you could kind of communicate what you're willing to do with council, I think this has got to be shrunk down some if we're going to be successful. You know, if we're going to put something in here, I don't want to be a mile away from where the other body's going to be and sit in here all night for nights and nights and end up down here where we got a lot of work to do between now and the 18th of May.
Mr. Chair,
so to the extent we can get some of that done before we put the bill on the floor of the Senate, that would be helpful.
That is great advice. I have sat in some of those conference committees and know the other side has a whole different perspective on things than us in the upper body.
Senator Limmer?
One last question, Mr. Chair. Senator Jungbauer, is there still a commuter rail stop at the Votech School planned?
No.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no.
I remember when we had this discussion, that was one of the selling points to attract votes, that there would have been a stop at the Votech School to ease the transportation needs of students up and down that line. And I don't think you'd need a parking ramp there because they've got a big parking lot. And why would you need a parking lot if you're coming and going from a school that you're going to rely on a commuter line to travel on? So I'm just curious why that was omitted. This is not the committee to answer that question, but I'm glad I asked it because it was part of the sales pitch to the legislature back when it originally started.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't know why and how all those stops got chosen in the end. I don't know if anybody from Anoka has any.
I know. Maybe I can address that in a more simplistic way, but it basically comes down to ridership studies. And there was a point at which that was a location, and Anoka and Ramsey were looking at that. Ramsey chose to offer another option, and that kind of split up the partnership, and then we were left with looking for where we would have an option. And the bottom line is the ridership studies showed that the Anoka station is a good travel shed for people to get on the train there. So that's how the Anoka station was put on the line.
Senator Dibble.
Well, I think we also have to look to the Federal Transit Administration and the much discussed cost effectiveness index, which is one of several indexes that are used to evaluate these transit lines. It kind of supersedes all the rest, and it emphasizes costs and minimizes benefits, and so we end up with some of these skewed decisions. So that'll change, though, going forward.
Subject to change.
Subject to change with the new administration and new chair of the Transportation Committee in Congress.
Senator Youngbar, if you could do some work on this tomorrow and Thursday, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, we'll get
but
it done.
I'll say it a second time. If we're too far apart, there's not going to be enough time to build the bridge, and some things are going to fall on the floor. It took us 2 years to get Fridley done, and they got less than you did. So just friendly advice.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't get involved in too many bills. That way I have more time to work on them and fine-tune them when I get
Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 1740 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your time.
On behalf of the city, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Senator Olson, Senate File 1561. Senator Olson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be here.
Senate File 1561 and actually 1560, the two bills that are coming up before you, are both requests for extension of the five-year rule. And I believe I had distributed before a handout that that review is a summary paper of the basis for the request and the background of the redevelopment TIF districts that they represent. Joining me today is from the city of Mound is Mayor Mark Hannis and Community Development Director Sarah Smith. Also here are council members Dave Osmek and Ray Salazar, as well as the attorney John Deans. I will let you know right up front that they took the precaution and have to comply with the open meeting law, since three members of the council are here, and it was published. But if it's all right with you, we'll forgo the there's an agenda, but we'll forgo the Pledge of Allegiance.
That would be very precedent-setting.
The request, the TIF district in both of these cases was formed, you know, 5 years before the expiration of this five-year rule. And Mound's TIF district was formed in 2005, and it is expiring in 2010. But they would like to look ahead, because they have been able to make a fair amount of progress with the redevelopment of the downtown area of Mound. It's the same story that you're hearing over and over again. The slump in housing has caused some difficulties that make it impossible to meet this five-year rule requirement. Mayor Hannis, would you like to give a little more explanation of
sure.
it, or you
sure.
to Sarah Smith, but we'll have him
would,
make
would ever like
comments.
To go.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing this case today. I will forego the introductions because Senator Olson's already done that. But as she stated, we do have a quorum of our council here today.
No,
this is very important to us. This is very important for our city, and we have taken time off our regular jobs to be here today. We are asking for a five-year extension to the five-year rule to TIF districts. This is a redevelopment district, and it is the core area of our new downtown area. This planning for this downtown area started nearly 20 years ago. It's been a long time progressing. It is a response to citizen requests, not developer proposals. It is community-driven, not developer-driven. This district covers really the last sections of our downtown redevelopment area. The TIF district does not cover our whole downtown. It is just a small portion, and Sarah perhaps could highlight that on one of the boards here. Really what you see is kind of where we started here and where we came to about, that picture's about a year old. This area has already seen significant public and private investment to prepare sites. We've got a ways to go yet, but we've come a long way. It's designed as a pedestrian district with retail, professional, and housing involved in it. But it is also a model multimodal transportation center. This transportation center includes a central parking area that includes park and ride facilities with restrooms, a public dockage area with access to our downtown by way of boats from Lake Minnetonka. It is a trailhead for the new Dakota Trail that is a bike and pedestrian trail that runs from Wayzata and will run all the way to Hutchinson. And I'll also mention that same trail is designed on the long-term plans of the Met Council to be a light rail corridor, and that runs right by our current park and ride area. So in the future, this has a high potential for serving light rail as well. So you've got foot traffic, you've got bicycles, buses, boats, trains, everything here in a matter of just a very few square city blocks, very small area.
And Mr. Chair, might I add that the ramp, which is a beautiful structure at the entry of this downtown area, was not built with TIF dollars.
So Mr. Mayor, is this a redevelopment district?
It is a redevelopment district.
All of it?
Yes. So the purpose, of course, is to strengthen our business climate, our tax base, and to recover the downtown identity that Mound once had. This is what the people of our city asked us to do. So why do we need the extension? Well, in a word, the economy. This area is extremely difficult to develop due to several different reasons, even in good times. And, of course, we're not in particularly good times right now. Every level of government that you can imagine has been involved in this project at one time or another. All of that slows the process and drags the process down. We're not a highway, or we don't have a highway running through town. We don't have Target and Walmart or anybody else, for that matter, courting us to come in and develop the area. We have to go out and sell it, so it's a very difficult area. In addition to that, it's very ecologically sensitive. It's right next to Lake Minnetonka, and for that reason, runoff is extremely sensitive. And we have worked closely with the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, and we are now actually a model city for them. They bring tours into our town to see what can be done with stormwater runoff.
Can you add the effect? Mr. Chairman, if I just might add, that's one of the things that I'm very impressed with, that the all of the phosphorus loading from the runoff of Mound was flowing into the lake from this area. And their plan has incorporated a model that, as he said, the Watershed District brings people to see, that is reducing that phosphorus loading by, I thought it was...
Sarah probably has the percentage.
It exceeds the minimum requirements for the watershed and is actually considered to be a leading model nationwide. And I think it's up to and probably exceeding a 75% phosphorus removal reduction. And anything within a certain amount of rainfall actually stays on the site and doesn't even filtrate into Minnetonka. So we are very, very proud of the partnership that we've had with the Watershed District. And I think the acronym that they use is we're kind of the three amigos, the watershed, the developer, and the city. And not only were they our partner to help design the model for our community, they also did the report on our behalf, but they were also a funding partner. And I think we were one of the first cities to entertain that type of relationship with the watershed. And as the senator indicated earlier, we've already had several tours coming to look at the different techniques. Rather than building the standard NERT pond, we're doing pervious pavers, we're doing pervious concrete, we're doing rainwater gardens, we're doing filtration basins, we're doing babbling brooks that look like little aesthetic waterways within our community, but they're actually treating water. We're using different types of hydric soils and hydric plants. So we're very pleased at the progress that we've made, and also because of the fact that I think we're on the cutting edge of great technology to improve with the overall benefit of improving water quality to Lake Minnetonka. So
it was Sarah Smith, Community Development Director from Mound, speaking.
So so where does that leave us? Well, like I say, we've come a long way. We're ready to move forward again. However, what do we need to move forward the next step? Well, we need businesses to move in, to sign up as tenants so we can progress with the development. That's where we are now, and that's where we're hung up, because the types of businesses we're trying to get down there are certainly not growing. They're trying to maintain their bottom line in the current business climate rather than focusing on growth. So that's what we have to do, is wait for the climate to get a little bit better so there's some growing interest in growth. So that's where we're at on that. We continue to prep the sites, but again, we're pretty stuck as far as actually moving in tenants. Go ahead.
I think I don't know if you have the full picture here, but Mr. Chair and members, the the site to the right of you, you can see the roadway going into Mauna. This is before. This is that's actually before some of the.
This is as we started. So that's the old county 15.
Yeah, that's an old one. But the buildings to the left of that are the main area for redevelopment now.
This area in here.
The greenish channel that you see coming. There's a greenway, but there's a channel from Lost Lake through Lost Lake coming
that's
in
more
from,
on that
from
board,
I can't
no.
see that one. So it's from Lake Minnetonka, that was where one of the old streetcar boats came into dock in Mound. But the buildings that are left, I would also say that City of Mound has not used eminent domain to acquire properties, and they have been acquiring them as they have become available, and they're about ready for some demolition of the old structures that are along that way. But interestingly enough, there's one more thing that's going to happen there the weekend of May 2nd.
Yes.
Homeland Security is going to be conducting a training session for communities around the whole area for potential terrorist attacks. So there's going to be some use of those buildings before they are destroyed.
So, Senator Olson, I assume that channel is still navigable?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's navigable, and one of the developments of townhomes where you see those docks, that has been townhomes that are partially built but are not moving, and that area is incomplete. Will each have docks that can navigate to Lake Minnetonka?
Are the boats too small, or are they just not at the docks?
Mr. Chair, they're not at the docks. These units, most of them have not been sold, or in fact have not been developed. That was a major area along that side where that development is. There was an old dump that they went through some major cleanup. So there's been a lot of work in restoring and getting a new face for the City of Mound.
How many units are built that aren't sold?
Sarah?
Mr. Chair, there out of the 37 proposed units, 11 have been constructed, and a building permit was issued for the first four-unit lakeside complex but was not constructed. In addition, all the docks and dredging activities were completed, and as well as the wetland remediation activities that were done in cooperation and under our obligation with our state permits, those activities were also completed. I believe six to eight, I believe.
11.
Yes, out of the 11.
But not to lose sight, we're not talking about all the docks in that area. The docks that are slated for the housing development are in the lower left quadrant of the board that you see. All the rest of the docks are public docks to be used for our downtown. So really, the whole top half of that dockage area is for public dockage for businesses to use. So anyway, just to conclude my thoughts on this, pardon me?
For customers to come to business.
For customers, exactly. So to conclude this, I just wanted to mention that over the last 20 years, four mayors and many, many more council members have devoted themselves to getting this development done. The citizens of Mound support this project as vigorously as the leadership does. Without this extension, the project will likely not proceed and could, in fact, die. All those past efforts and expenditures and investments would have a very difficult time being recovered. So this is very important to us. With that, I will ask Sarah if she has anything that she needs to add, or if not, then we stand
Mayor,
for questions.
Are you capturing enough increment today to pay for those upfront costs that you put in?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Are you capturing enough increment today to pay for the debt service on that work that was done?
Not as of yet, because the district hasn't been completed to the point where it can recover. That's what we need to get the extension so we can reach that point.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add a couple follow-up comments. Again, I'm Sarah Smith. I'm the planner. I think there's a couple really compelling points with regards to Mound's project that I'd just like to share. First and foremost, this has been a very long time, and as the mayor alluded to, it was and has been and always will continue to be community-driven. There is long since a need to have a new community, to have a new downtown, to bring people in, to have a sense of place for members of the folks that live with us, both the residents and the business community. Secondly, there's been a lot of effort put in on behalf of the city, and it started from a very basic land use perspective, a concept plan that was put together, a cooperation of business leaders, community leaders, residents, interested parties, to come up with what was called the Mound Vision. The Mound Vision was basically focusing on a couple of things: pedestrian orientation, bringing transit into downtown, making Mound walkable, improving different modes of transportation, bringing a sense of place back to Mound, and bringing water into the downtown. Basically, a nice place to visit, a nice place to live. Thirdly, with that concept in place, the zoning ordinance was amended to accommodate that. The comprehensive plan was set up to focus on our redevelopment efforts. The next thing was we did a complete AUAR of the whole entire downtown area, with the thought that we wanted to understand what the ramifications would be of the downtown to our community. And again, for a community of between 9 and 10,000 people, that's a big undertaking, and it took us about a year and a half to 2 years to get through that. And I think it was a tremendous step for the city to take in cooperation with the developer. Following that activity, we went through the tax increment financing plan. We got the developer under contract, who's been with us now since 2004. We got our land use approvals in place, and then we started the construction. And I think probably the most important part that I want to make sure I share is that this project has been supported not only locally, but I think up to 12 agencies that have been financially supportive, helped us with our permits, helped us with problems as we've encountered them. Everyone from Deed to the Met Council to Hennepin County Regional Rail to the county. We relocated a road. We built a regional trail. We did a dredge.
Post office?
Yeah, and we also relocated a post office in the middle of a federal moratorium. So we're very proud of those efforts. And I think if I can share one thing with you, is that Mound has done this with the help of others and all of the agencies. And we always kind of kid ourselves saying, I'm not sure there's anybody we haven't had to get permits from. So we've been thrilled with the relationships that we've forged. And I think, but for that, I don't think this project would be as successful as it has been, despite the economy that we're in. And the also is that we've had a great developer that's helped us partner with them, and great leadership. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Olson, how long is the channel to get out to the lake?
Oh, about, I would say 2,000 feet, maybe. He's a navigable guy.
It's probably close to a quarter of a mile, at least, or maybe over.
Yeah, it's...
And there is,
well, maybe not quite a quarter mile. Yeah. I'd guess it to be about 500 yards or something like that.
The channel is, Mr. Chair, the channel is through a very large marsh, and it has to go. The boats have to go under a bridge because there is a county road that is just the side of the residential.
So was it a long established waterway, or what do you have to go through to get the permits to dredge that out?
That actually is a project that goes back, I think, to 99. But I think first and foremost, it's great that you understand that was a historical channel.
Yes.
It was called the Lost Lake Historical Channel, and the focus of our efforts was to reclaim and be able to do that. I wasn't on board when that project went forward, but I am aware that through ICE-T and through the various levels of permitting, it was a very complicated project. But we were able to get our permits through the Corps and I'm sure DNR and other agencies, maybe Bowser, that were participating. We also received federal dollars assist with that project as well.
Those were two ICE-T grants from the federal government that covered the majority of that project, yes.
And Mr. Chair, I've lived out there over 50 years now, and that channel has always been open, but it has silted in at times, but it's been navigable for much of that time with smaller boats.
Any questions, members? Senator Olson, we've had a lot of requests for waiving the five-year rule, and we're going to do something on that. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly what it looks like yet, whether it'll be city specific or something a little broader, but okay. going to do something on this issue.
Mr. Chair, just judging from the numbers that you're talking about, that might be a wise way to go. The second one I have is quite similar, a little different character of community, but a little bit different. But appreciate your consideration.
Chair lays over Senate File 1561. Mr. Mayor, Ms. Smith, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank
members.
You very much,
Mr. Chair. Members, thank you.
You know, Senator Olson, you know, maybe when the conference committee is meeting, we should go out and take a little tour around that channel.
I'll bet the ice will be gone.
Yeah, I bet the ice will be gone.
We'd love to have you.
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of interesting things to say, and while you're at it, we could take a look at the beautiful Big Island Park that was made possible with a partial investment from the state and the Watershed District and the City of Orono, and has been doing some great things.
Senator Olson, do we know anybody with a pontoon boat?
I could arrange that in a hurry and maybe better than that.
We could fit a couple House conferees on there. Under the new rules, Senator Pogemiller, can we have two House, two Senate conferees go for a ride and look at this project?
Two and two you can have.
Two and two we can have?
Just can't have a quorum.
Can't have two and three anymore? Has the House passed those rules yet?
No, you can still have two and three.
Anyway.
Mr. Chair, after dark you can do anything.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
And I'll ask the mayor of Medina.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. We'll see you soon.
If I were Chair Lincheski, I'd want to have a bodyguard with me.
Senator Olson, Senate File 1560.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1560 is for the City of Medina, making the same request of the extension of the five-year rule. And with me today is Mayor Tom Crosby of the City of Medina. You have a little two-page handout that just reviews the background of this TIF district. It is a redevelopment district, and it is... Medina, you may know, Medina is a larger land area of similar to a township. I think it is a township size.
26 square miles.
It's actually a partial township. The lower level part of the City of Orono came off from that, what had been the original township. But it does encompass a city, or what we often know. We often think about Hamel, and you may have heard of it or driven through it on Highway 55. There's a big Hamel rodeo out there every year, and Hamel has a post office. Medina does not, but Hamel actually is a part of Medina. So it's the Hamel area that is the kind of the focal point of this TIF district, and I'll turn it over to Mayor Crosby to explain a little bit about the status of...
Senator Olson, somebody with a Medina, is there a Medina address then and a zip code?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is not a Medina address. I believe the U.S. Post Office does allow people to use the name of a city as long as they have the right zip code. But Medina, I think Mayor Crosby could tell me how many different post offices residents of Medina receive their mail from.
They have Hamel, Wayzata, Long Lake, and Maple Plain are all post offices. Medina has no specific post office. Let me just introduce Medina a little bit because it is confusing. It has Plymouth on the east and Orono to the south. In Medina is the headquarters of Polaris. In Medina is the major Hennepin County maintenance facility, where you may have read. If not, you're going to see. We recently passed permission for them to put up a 410-foot wind turbine on the Hennepin County property. It'll be either a 2.5 or a 3.0 megawatt wind turbine, which I think will be the largest in the Twin City area. It'll be comparable but more powerful to those that are in Northfield. We also have Baker Park within our city. And finally, we have the Medina Ballroom, which has been a long-term stalwart. What we are doing here, and I apologize for not having any visuals, but it's a very simple circumstance. Senator Olson is correct. The town of Hamel is within Medina but has no independent legal recognition. And the only difference between us and Mound, we are affected by the economy, but we have a sense of urgency that they do not, in that our redevelopment TIF district expires on July 9 of 2009.
The five-year rule.
The five-year rule. I might just, as an aside, say I actually applaud the five-year rule because I think it adds a sense of discipline to cities, and we have been very diligent in our recognition of the five-year rule. We have had two bond issues under TIF so far. The first improved one street but also permitted us to put stormwater treatment facilities in that we will use for the rest of Medina. The second was done last summer, a major improvement of Hamel Road in downtown Hamel. If one turns the clock back about 40 years, Hamel had three grocery stores. It had a lumber yard. It has a bank, which is still there, a hardware, and I am told at least three bars. What's going on in Hamel right now is the bank is still there. We have very substantial interest in two restaurants. Unfortunately, the economy has stalled, and there's several tracts that are under foreclosure. Actually, I think that they will be used in the restaurant that is there. We are here to ask for an extension of our five-year period. The dollars involved in Medina are relatively small. The bond issue for the road was, I believe, $1.2 million. And we there have been improvements. There was a new bank, actually a credit union, that just opened last fall. So in answer to the chairman's question, are the bonds covered? They mostly are, and with relatively little economic development, we believe that the outstanding bonds will be covered by the tax increment, and we're hoping that going forward that we could issue some bonds that would be used for housing. Actually, the bonds the expenditures would really be in two areas, either further street improvements or we would we would do municipal parking. We would actually buy some land where we could in the future put ramped parking, but it would initially be used for surface parking. I will end there. I think that this is important to the city, and the Senator Olson has I think given to each of you a two-page summary of what we're about.
Mr. Mayor, what percentage of the project is built out as you had originally contemplated it?
Well, if you look at the totality of the tax increment district, north of Highway 55, there is a target facility. The target facility has actually been built out, but those revenues, the tax increments there are dedicated to the target-specific improvements. As to the south side, which is where we are looking, very little of it has been built out. There is as I mentioned, the Great West Credit Union, and I think there will be another commercial facility that will go alongside of that. But the only other one, there is a three-story condominium project that has been built in the area as well.
So what's the advantage of a five-year extension on the existing district over just creating if there's adequate revenue here, what's the advantage over just creating a new district?
One could create a new district. The only advantage is, frankly, the red tape of having to do it.
Anything else, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, one other little highlight since we've been bringing up a little history. Some of you that were around here when we had a little bit of an uproar where there was a gentleman who claimed to be part of a sovereign nation that was going to acquire the parcel of land that was a builder's building company that's now redeveloped and where the Target store is, and was going to put up a casino. And so there was a bit of fury going on out in Medina over the potential of a casino coming to to this neighborhood.
Is the land still available?
That's part of the completed part of the redevelopment on the north side. So it's.
Is there other land?
No, I think that if one looks at the totality of what's happened, the Target store has come in. It's been quite a vital starting point, and our hope is that building on the Target store, that we can create what the excitement mostly. Affordable housing in Hamel. We don't expect it to be as much of a vital economic entity as it might have been 50 years ago, but we do think that it can be a place for housing and some retail.
Mr. Mayor, when the big box retailer came in, what was the impact on small local businesses that previously had been established there?
Really, only one business closed. There was a hardware in Hamel. Candidly, my suspicion is that hardware would have closed had Target not come. But there is another project. It's right. It's in Plymouth. There was the possibility of a major senior care facility, which. I think the economy was the death knell for that project. But I think that if there are more housing, I think that Hamel will be kind of a focal point for that. The final thing I should mention is there's a major park facility that the Hamel, that the city of Medina supports. We're going to, I think there are 8 baseball fields. There's used to be called Hamel, now the Medina Community Center. And I believe that that with more roofs out there, that the downtown Hamel will become much more vibrant.
Mr. Chair, I do have a map of showing that park is outside of the TIF district.
But it's an amenity.
It's an amenity that would serve particularly the Hamel area. I just have one. I apologize that I didn't make copies of this. But you can see the north of the larger part was in the north of Highway 55. The Hamel, kind of the old Hamel downtown, is a smaller area, and that's where the focal point of the redevelopment and the need is for the extension of the 5-year rule, because the other is pretty well developed out. So if you would like to pass that around, it's.
Mr. Mayor, explain to me again the relationship between the city of Medina and, is it the town of Hamel then?
Yes, the town of Hamel has never existed as an independent entity. It's always been within Medina. But Hamel has its, I'm just trying to think of another comparable circumstance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Navarre was an area and has a post office, but it's in Orono. Orono has Crystal Bay was a small little nucleus, and there's still a post office there, but it's Orono. So they have some within. In the city I live in, Minnetrista, actually Mound, the community that was just represented, is about 3 sections out of what was the Minnetrista township, and to the west of us is 1 section that incorporated and is the city of St. Bonifacius. And now Minnetrista is incorporated too. So Medina incorporated, but it included Hamel, which was the post office.
Actually,
in that area.
Historically, Medina was a township that included Orono.
Yes.
And as a mayor of a community that it does have very much of an identity crisis, it's often confused with Edina. And we also have Hamel has a fire department, but Medina itself is served by 4 fire departments: Long Lake, Maple Plain, Loretto, which is a freestanding city within Medina, and Hamel.
So there are other freestanding cities within the city of Medina.
That's correct.
Medina. Is that what we're
talking
about?
One. Loretto. Loretto is a carve-out. It's a freestanding city within Medina.
Loretto is to Medina as St. Bonnie is to Minnetrista.
Senator Pogamo, you chaired this committee. Have you ever run into that?
Senator Olson, if you want to ruin your career, you should consolidate services out there.
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of shared services. I do, but it is kind of unique that I do represent 20 cities in Hennepin County. That's more than any other Hennepin County legislature.
But this curiously, I mean, the we are, it's unrelated to this particular, but we are very acutely exploring consolidating fire departments, for example, because for one city to support four fire departments and to have to buy equipment for four fire departments makes very little sense. So that's one of the things that I'm really doing as mayor, is trying to put as much possible consolidation into this as possible.
Mr. Mayor, I think that's very worth your time. Senator Limerick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I used to represent Medina a few years ago. My district is just to the north of it now. But for those who live in the cities or lives out in rural Minnesota, this is common to have. When you have compression of population in the suburban area, you'll have a township that turns into a city. But in the township, there'll be a collection of incorporated and unincorporated towns, crossroads, that little hamlets and villages have sprung up in, because it's just where things are. And so, Hamel is a kind of a cute little town. It's on the south side of Highway 55 and a rail line. But it's kind of a drive-by. If you don't know really where it is, you drive right past it. And all of your attention is diverted to the north side, where you have a little bit of the retail and a little commercial businesses. The unique thing about Medina is that they really don't have a lot of property wealth. They have a lot of residential. They've got a lot of rural, but the industrial element is right along Highway 55 corridor, and that's it. And you don't have a lot of because of it there. It follows kind of the interceptor lines, the sewer and water and gas that comes through that town, but it's mostly along that highway. If there's any other development that needs to be put in anywhere, it really does need a little bit of a boost from a TIF district.
And, we do have a very substantial residential tax base in the southern portion. It
right.
picks up a lot of the Orono, continues. It's a very much of a rural area. But we are committed, because we are in the MUSA, within the MUSA dine, to put much more higher density population in the next 20 years. Yeah. And Hamel is really the focal point of that.
The key to that, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, one time I was going to Corcoran, and I overshot the mark, and ended up in Medina. And I was on a cul-de-sac there, and those houses must have been million-dollar houses. It's huge.
There are a lot of large houses in Medina, yes.
So you might not have a commercial industrial base, but you sure got a residential
base.
Yes,
we do. We do.
It's fabulous.
Mr. Mayor, how many square miles was Medina?
26 square miles in Medina.
26 square miles.
Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer Senator Hogan-Miller's question, I think Lexington is inside of Lionel Lakes.
And Mr. Mayor, how many acres is the TIF district?
Oh, the TIF district would be maybe 25 acres. That's kind of a guess.
You got Rochester. It's a nightmare.
Anything else, members? Another five-year rule issue. We understand the state of the economy and
Mr. Chairman,
some of these projects have slowed down.
The other thing about the Senator Langseth's got the map, but just in the last, I bet, 7 or 8 years, that intersection has just become kind of a nightmare. 55 and 101. There's a lot of people use 101 now to go north. Yeah. It's like it's starting to become kind of the preferred entrance to the freeway, so that you can avoid a bunch of traffic. I mean, now there's a target on that intersection where you do come in on 101 and the freeway. So
you are also if you go down 3/4 of a mile, you come to 116. That's also because that's a direct shot to Rogers. That has also, and we are working with Hennepin County in the state of Minnesota to do improvements on 116. That's currently within our. The final thing I will say, that may be alleviated because of the so-called Long Lake Bypass on Highway 12, which just opened about 3 months ago. So now you can go down 19 through Independence, and you can go down to Highway 12, and that has made a huge difference in traffic patterns in the western suburbs, and I think is yet to be fully implemented.
Need better signage, too. You should talk to somebody, because once they opened that, it was kind of like you're
there were a lot
gone.
Of people, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, we had some signage challenges, but it was mainly how do you get back into Long Lake?
That's
and,
right.
And the businesses there were suffering. But they've accommodated that, and it's settling
out. Fixed it.
Yeah. So.
Anything else, members?
I opened that box.
Again, Senator Olson, we're going to figure out something to do about this five-year rule issue that people are bumping up against. Yours is the more urgent one I can see. It expires in
yes,
July.
Yes, we are urgent.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to work with you in any way I can help.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for coming down.
Thank you very much.
Senator Olson, Chair Lee is over. Senate Bill 1860.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rest.
Members.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This will be exciting. Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjo, I would just point out to Senator Rest, we've been waiting for bated breath for this bill.
Ooh.
With bated breath for this bill.
Ooh.
Very interesting bill.
Tell us all about it.
Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is a bill that proposes to expand the taxpayer protections regarding tax anticipation loans and tax anticipation checks. Minnesota was one of the first in the nation some 6 years ago to begin to set conduct standards for those that prepare tax returns other than CPAs and attorneys, and this proposal was brought to me by the legal aid folks. Mr. Elwood is here, and it responds to some additional problems that that legal aid has identified, and that advocates for these clients and tax clients have wanted to point out to us, and proposes strengthening those standards. So we also got help on some of the issues from H&R Block, and we know of no particular opposition to the bill at this point. I'd like to just go through the provisions for it in it to start with. First of all, Section 1 deals with scope and indicates who it does not apply to. People who have, for example, fewer than 10 clients a year, people who have who do their tax returns for only immediate family, someone who prepares a tax return for the employer's business, et cetera. Also, the nonprofit preparers that work in the VITA programs and other programs that prepare tax returns for low-income people and or seniors. Subdivision 1 is the scope, Subdivision 2 includes the definitions and distinguishes between refund anticipation loans and refund anticipation checks, and brings into the definition section what a refund anticipation check is. Subdivision 3 increases the the standards of conduct to which a tax preparer, once again, other than CPAs and attorneys who are held to, within their own professions, a standard of conduct and a code of ethics. And one of the things that occasioned this, even in 2003, is that tax preparers, they don't have to have any particular education level. They don't have to have continuing education. That there was found to be a great deal of variety in level of expertise and experience, et cetera. And so we began this project of having standards of conduct, and a number of them are added to those that are already in statute. Subdivision 3A deals with requiring a written requirement when a tax preparer is going to offer the opportunity either for a refund anticipation loan or a refund anticipation check. It also addresses the issue that was brought up by H&R Block about mandatory arbitration. If a written agreement includes a mandatory arbitration clause, the tax preparer has to provide a separate notice to the client and indicating that arbitration is the exclusive means of dispute resolution for any dispute that's about the written agreement, and that the client has the right to opt out of the arbitration clause within a month of entering into it, and that the client's not bound to the arbitration if the claim or the dispute involves some other violation by the tax preparer. The subdivision 4 details what the required disclosures are. The stricken language appears elsewhere in the bill and in reorganizing the section. The for 4A and subdivision 4A are listed the disclosures that are required for a refund anticipation loan, including the exact language that has to go on the written agreement. 4B is the disclosures that are required for a refund anticipation check, including, once again, the exact language that must be on the disclosure. Subdivision 5 requires a itemized fee when a tax preparer offers a refund anticipation check or a refund anticipation loan, and indicating the fee that not only for the return preparation, but also adding a fee, adding in the itemization whatever fee is associated with the provision of the refund anticipation check. It was already in law that they had to do that for a refund anticipation loan. Subdivision 5 gives the right to a client to rescind a refund anticipation loan or gives him one full day, gives that person one full day, business day, to rescind that agreement that was previously signed, doing that by written notification, returning the original check that was issued for the loan, or giving the amount of the loan back in cash to the tax preparer, and indicates that the tax preparer, if the loan is rescinded, may charge a fee for doing so. Subdivision 6 details the penalties that are that would be in place for violation of these requirements. And subdivision 6A involves the exchange of data that is now be required not only for the refund anticipation loans, but also refund anticipation checks, and that's also all of 6A, 6B, 6C. In subdivision 7, there is the right of a client to bring a civil action against a tax preparer who violates this section, and then indicates what the statutory damages may be for that kind of violation if the courts find it to be so. And then there are limited exceptions again to the rule or exemptions from this section, and they include those who are attorneys or CPAs or enrolled agents who are already held to an independent set of standards, and goes back to subdivision one that refers to the scope and who the bill applies to and who it doesn't. So, Mr. Chairman, Legal Aid worked some time on bringing this proposal to increase the protections for taxpayers who go to tax preparers other than CPAs and attorneys, again, who are held to a different set of standards. And they're not only a different set, they're even a higher set of standards for providing this information. What they are held to, however, in this bill, they're certainly held to the notion of if a CPA or an attorney or an enrolled agent offers the refund anticipation check or the refund anticipation loan, they're held to the same requirements of offering a full business day of, I mean, a written agreement and a full business day for the taxpayer to rescind the agreement.
Senator Rest, do we have any kind of cap on the interest rate on these kind of instruments, or what is a monthly interest rate on if I wanted to do the a refund anticipation
loan? Mr. Albert can
loan.
Give you that information, I think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. There is no cap contained in this bill at all. The interest rate ranges dramatically among tax preparers. If you calculate it on an APR basis, it's extraordinarily high, but these are very short-term loans, a couple of days, so the APRs seem awful high.
How about on a monthly rate, so we don't end up in the thousands of percentages?
Well, they generally are, I guess, the range is in the hundreds of percents. But again, you know, they're only taking the loan for a couple of days, so it's the amount of money that's actually extracted in comparison to where the what they're getting is relatively small. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the RALs, but I think to be fair and characterize in terms of the interest rates, you have to look at it in the time that the rate is in effect, and it's a very, very short time.
So which one of them is used more, the loan or the check?
Mr. Chair, members, the loan is by far the largest product. The check is really only for the fees. When people they use the check product when people come in and they're unable to afford the fees up front, and so what they do is they do the tax preparation, and the contract will allow them then to essentially intercept the amount of the fees plus some additional administrative, the refund, right. And so they also get the amount of the tax prep fees plus some administrative fees as well.
So if a taxpayer was going to be getting a $1,000 refund but couldn't pay for the fees, then they would be issued a refund check minus what the fees were, so that the fees could be taken out of their refund check, which is different from the loan.
So it doesn't end up rolled into a loan?
No. A refund anticipation check is not a refund anticipation
check. It just lowers the refund when the refund comes.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair and members, it allows people who are unable to afford the upfront fee to be able to get their taxes done through a private a tax preparer without having to front the fees. That's the nature of that product.
Is the utilization of, if Mr. Elwood, is the utilization of these kind of instruments increasing?
Mr. Chair and members, actually the utilization is decreasing. There's been a lot of publicity, a lot of it negative about these products. And I think nationally it's having its effect. However, that's not to say that the utilization is small. There are millions and millions and millions of dollars nationally, well, actually billions nationally, and in Minnesota, millions, probably upwards of $20 million every year that wind up getting diverted from the taxpayers' refund towards these loans and fees.
How many years has this industry been around?
Mr. Chair and members, I've been doing this work here at the Capitol for 10 years, and it's been around ever since I've been here, so I think it's...
And we did the first restrictions 6 years ago in 2003, which addressed just the refund anticipation loans. And then they came up with this new product, the refund anticipation check, and we're addressing that here, plus giving additional standards of conduct.
And Mr. Chair, members, I really do think we should, I'd like to give some credit to H&R Block. They were very constructive when they looked at this bill. They actually, in some cases, made it even better. And they've been very easy to work with. So I really think they deserve credit for coming in a constructive manner with us on this bill.
Mr. Frignito, is this a good idea? Nodding his head, yes. I take it the CPAs, Senator Rester, are okay?
Mr. Chairman, there's no opposition from bona fide groups.
Okay. Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, is there any kind of enactment time frame that we should be considering?
The effective date, if that's what you're asking for. There's a silence on the effective date, so I'm assuming that it's takes effect
August.
July 1, August 1. August 1.
Yeah. Default.
Mr. Frignito?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gino Frignito with the Minnesota CPA Society, and in the process of developing this bill, Mr. Elwood has worked with us in our organization and has addressed our concerns, and we did work with them back in 2003 in the initial process and are comfortable with where they're at today.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Sanjo?
Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses, I think I know the answer to my question, but as for instance, would there be any unintended consequences of this bill to a business that actually had within it a core of staff people that did income tax for their staff members?
It doesn't apply to them.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Center.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Senator Rest. Chair lays over Senate File 616.
Appreciate it.
Where's mine? Members, you have in your packet today kind of a tentative schedule of the committee's work. We got kind of a flurry of bill introductions over the last couple of days. So this is tentative, but you'll notice we have to, our intent is to have a tax bill ready for the committee and the public to see on the 21st and take it up here on the 22nd of April and take all the amendments and stay here as long as we have to that day to get it up to the floor.
What day was that?
The 22nd. Remember, there's this chart everybody's got. And
I got it.
And we'll email it out. We'll have staff email it out to the committee members so those that aren't here can see it.
Should be in your thing. It's your paper.
Yeah, and so this will kind of help you with planning a little bit. And if you can take a look at the 14th, right after the Easter break, We're gonna change our meeting time that day to 12:30 so that people coming in from vacation or coming from home don't have to be here at 8:30 in the morning. And then we have the room reserved all afternoon. So, and then we'll meet the next morning, the 15th, too, and then that's about it for members' bills that are going to be considered for inclusion. So if you have something as a member of the committee, we need to get it introduced so we can get it over here.
All right.
Senator Rest? You have one coming yet.
Yes, we just got it from the Assistant Majority Leader's office, but it'll be in tomorrow's introductions.
Okay. Anything else, members? The Property Tax Division is going to meet tomorrow and the full committee Thursday at 8:30, and we've got members' bills up again on Thursday. Committee's adjourned.